Thanks, everybody, for being here. The mic in this room works better than the mic in my last breakout. That's good to hear. We're excited to do this panel on advancing distributed generation. We do not have slide presentations today, so you'll just be looking at our mugshot here. I've got a series of questions for the panelists, and then we're going to make sure there's plenty of time for audience Q&A to get your input. I know there's a lot of excitement about distributed generation. So first, want to give everybody a chance to introduce themselves. And Steve, just as a note, we are recording this, and so talk through the mic because it's not ambient recording; it's going through that mic. It is on the record, but not necessarily for publication. I don't know where it's going, but it is on the record. So I know you got corporate policies. So I'm Tyler Huebner, Executive Director of Renew Wisconsin. Happy to moderate this, and we'll kick to Steve to just give 1 to 2 minute intro from each of the panelists here.
All right, I'm Steve Nealon. I'm Vice President of System Engineering for Decentric. We're a affiliate of Faith Technologies. We recently reorganized at the first of the year and spinning up a separate energy division. Decentric, the division I work in, now deals strictly with distributed generation, distributed energy resourcing.
So. Great. Nick?
My name is Nick Mathis. Is that better? Okay. My name is Nick Mathis. I work for the Midwest Renewable Energy Association. We're a nonprofit that focuses on trainings in the renewable energy industry. And my background is electrical. I'm a master electrician. I've built a fair amount of solar electric systems throughout the days, and now I work full-time in our training, continuing education, workforce development programs, and one of the things we focus heavily on is inspector training, continuing education for electricians, making sure that systems go in with the highest level of quality that we can get.
Adam Gussie with Sunvest Solar, VP of Operations, so I head up the construction arm and the get things done side of our development team. We work throughout Wisconsin, Illinois, a good Midwestern contingent, but also do projects throughout the country. I think our farthest reach this year was Spokane, Washington to Akwesasne, New York. So we get to luckily get to stay home some, but role here, actively involved in the state with interconnection standards and rules, worked with a lot of different utilities in the state, as well as with a lot of different contractors and organizations. So.
Great, thanks guys. We're going to talk about some of the kind of key policies that have been around for a long time in Wisconsin, how they're going, things we can improve, and then as we look ahead, how technologies are changing and emerging, working together with utility scale and how we can grow this thing. So that's kind of the architecture here. We've got processes and policies that have started in the late 70s, early 80s around interconnection of these DERs, distributed energy resources, net metering policies dating back in the state to 1981 and 82, some of the early rulings of the Public Service Commission. These have evolved over time, though. But what remains today is for our marketplace of distributed generation, net metering remains a very key policy. The interconnection rules, permitting and inspection and actually getting the projects, you know, approved and built and installed. These are some of the key foundational pieces that we're going to talk about today to this market. Focus on energy has also been a key incentive program. And Michael talked about this at the beginning of the day, but over the past couple years, there's about nearly 1,000 last year and about 900 this year. Solar PV systems incentivized through Focus on Energy. Each year, about 15 megawatts of new solar installed. So we are growing this marketplace, which is good to see. And costs have been a tailwind. Cost declines have been a big tailwind for renewables in general, but for distributed energy from $10 a watt. Who in the room remembers $10 a watt solar? Quite a few of us, okay. So that's, you know, come down to, you know, in the $2 per watt range for larger commercial projects, in the $3 per watt range for residential. But costs seem to be leveling out a little bit between, you know, we've squeezed a lot of the fat out, number one, but you've got new National Electric Code obligations for, you know, basically DC optimizers. So that, you've got some tariff issues that are maybe coming and going. So it feels like, you know, prices are starting to stabilize. Maybe they're going to keep going down, but probably not as sharply as they have. What does that mean for the market? So what can we further do to lower those costs from other ways, right? Inspection, interconnection, those kind of things, so that we can keep growing this market. That's some of what we want to talk about today. So first off, we're just going to hear a little bit about the markets that you're serving. So tell us a little bit about the markets that your company is serving and where you're seeing growth and opportunities.
All right. So from our perspective, we work at this point primarily in the C&I space and in utility scale, depending on which division of faith we're talking about. One thing, you know, I've noticed probably in the past 8 to 12 months, a lot of what we had seen in the past was all based around return on investment. What can I do for savings? What can I do to cut my bill? Hearing a lot more interest now in sustainability. Okay, we understand that this may help save us some money, but we really want to look at what we can do to lower our carbon footprint or what we can do to go to more renewable energy sources and less carbon-based fuels. So that's been a really encouraging aspect of everything we're seeing with the, not just with the price policies, but just with kind of a change in attitudes and a change in perspective.
Great, Nick.
Well, as a nonprofit, we have a good variety of our customer base, or our members would be small to medium-sized business and residential. And so we see a good swath of, you know, different reasons for going with renewables. And, you know, kind of like you mentioned, there's going to be a lot of sustainability in there, but price always comes in as a good factor. I mean, sustainability is kind of one of those underlying reasons for doing it. But as we make solar more cost competitive and more accessible to everyone, it growth continues there.
So. And how about you, Adam, at Sunvest? What kind of markets are you guys serving? Where are you seeing growth and opportunities as you look ahead?
Well, I like to look back at, like they said it this morning, in Wisconsin is crazy. You don't have any mandates, legislative, RPS, nothing that really sets up a requirement to do it, and people are just recognizing from residential customers, nonprofits, community organizations, utilities, everybody sees that it makes sense. And you can see some other markets that we're active in that are completely different. There's a lot, we do some development in Illinois, and you see what happens to a state when it's mandated. And then you see how utilities, regulators, and then the general community in that state, how they respond and go to meet that goal. And it's just different here. We don't have the requirement to do it, but we all have goals now that we're self-creating, either from utilities or regulators. The exciting thing that is fun to watch is that you get it in all sectors. And I think a lot of it is fed by excitement and more information getting out there, like the group buys that help to amplify the amount of residential that's getting installed, the nonprofit outreach and grant programs that are getting, you know, philanthropic started. And then you've got utilities asking for rate policies when before it was, well, usually that would be getting told to you by the Public Service Commission. So I see that there's the utility growth is one large piece of it, but you see the installations are still coming from individual residential customers, you know, 5.5 megawatts last year of just solar put on homes, and then things on nonprofits and businesses are a big pool as well that creates a lot of opportunity in the state.
Yeah, when I started at Renew Wisconsin in 2013, I think we went from 17 megawatts to 25 in that year. So, you know, up to 2012, we had 17 megawatts from what we could count. And now we're doing 15 a year with focus on energy between homes and businesses. So, you know, that speaks to the market growth that we've seen. So let's start in and talk a little bit about net metering policy. This has been a policy that's been around a long time. For folks that don't know, it's the simplest analogy is basically rollover minutes for your solar power. So the sun's clearly out in the day. On a home, for example, you're making more power than you're probably using during those hours. But net metering allows you to bank those credits and basically soak them up at night or seasonally too, depending on the utility. So how critical, I'll start with Adam over you, has net metering been historically and kind of as you look ahead to the residential sector, the nonprofit sector, and then the business? As you go up in size, net metering doesn't qualify as much depending on the utility. So sort of what's working well with net metering, and is there anything you think can be improved?
Yeah, it's definitely a driver of project size when the decision's made on economics. It depends on what the customer wants to accomplish with their project. But the ability to not match your generation instantaneously to what the load in the building is frees up meeting larger percentage goals of your output. So having an increased size obviously will start to increase your overall project size that you typically see, which we've seen in 100 kilowatt net metering in Xcel and MG&E territory, mm-hmm. which expanded what commercial customers could do versus 20 kilowatts. For a commercial customer, a lot of times they can only get to a small percentage and may not choose to do a project mm-hmm. because of that. So it makes just more of the design and overall driver for that development a little bit different, but also changing the window. So whether it's a net monthly, net annual, or net instantaneous, as some cooperatives will tell you, it really changes how you approach system design and an overall what project makes most sense for a customer financially, or if they're doing it for sustainability goals, how you can still make it make sense. We ran into it with our net zero community where the covenant said that the homes had to offset 100% of their electrical usage for the year, but the net metering policy is month to month, so they're having their dollar is not completely offset, but right. they're offsetting their electrical consumption right. from that array, so it makes things kind of backwards. Or what it does in the end is it starts to incentivize storage solutions now that they're starting to make more financial sense, because you're creating a financial value for keeping your power in your home versus net metering, which allows you to freewheel it out into and get paid at retail rate. So as you see those net metering rates change, then you start to see more storage installations, which happened greatly in We Energies territory, where they shifted mm-hmm. to a net monthly. You had companies like Arch Electric that was installing a lot of storage for customers, because then they could keep a higher valued rate for their system.
Yeah, Steve, with the CNI customers, does net metering play in that space as much? And if not, how would net metering improve if you could do that? Or is it not needed at this point for those larger systems?
It definitely comes into play. I mean, so, you know, the first thing we'll look at with a client is looking at, you know, what – where are you at in your energy journey? You know, what have you saved? What is your facility look like? And then the second thing we look at is who's your utility, because that really shapes the way we engineer and design a system. You know, as Adam pointed out, it has a huge impact. You know, do I look at storage? Do I don't look at storage? Mm-hmm. How is it going to affect the bill and the return on investment, especially in that commercial space? And it can be a totally different proposition if I'm working with a similar company in We Energies territory where I've got a 300 kW versus something in one of the utilities where I'm looking at a 10 or 20 kW yeah. situation. So,
I mean, how do those clients handle it when you're working with a client that straddles multiple utility territories, and it's like, well, we can do this here and we can only do that there? Why is that? Does that come up?
It comes up, and quite often they have a difficult time understanding that.
Yeah.
It's like, well, isn't this all the same? Isn't it all the same? It's like, no, it depends on the utility.
Or it changes by the time they do their project.
Or it changes by the time they do the project.
which happens.
Or we actually have had some utilities where it changes based on where you're in the utility's jurisdiction also.
Right. Yeah.
So it's like, okay, I've got a location in this area, and it's at this level. I've got a location that's 300 miles away, and it's at this level. And why is that?
Yeah. Okay.
So it's difficult for them to understand. And then the next question is, well, isn't that regulated? And it's like, the answer is no. That's up to the utility.
Yeah. Well, it's approved by the Public
it's
Service
approved,
Commission. But yes.
Yeah. But yeah. they're the ones
it's,
who.
It is utility by utility. So I guess one of the questions for our market, as we're thinking about wanting to do more distributed generation, is trying to make that consistent across utility territories to the extent possible. Would that be sort of a dream for you guys? Would that make your lives easier, are you working through it and you figured out the answers? I don't know.
I think it depends. I mean, if it's on the high end, it probably helps. If it's on
I'm talking about streamlining to the good.
Yeah, streamlining to the good side. Yeah, yes, absolutely.
Right.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah. 300
kilowatts, 500 kilowatts.
and Nick, Nick, I know at MREA you're not so as involved in the day-to-day, but you've had a history with H&H and your own business. I mean, anything you want to chime in on how net metering affects certain customers and projects, we'd love to hear it.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think you guys kind of hit the point pretty well that across the different utilities, just having some sort of standardization is going to help you definitely see different projects driven by different utility policies. And you'll see that more in the agricultural and commercial, not so much as in the residential, but it makes a big difference if a farmer can put up a 20 kilowatt, if they're capped at a 20 kilowatt net metered system and they want to go a lot higher, it just makes a huge difference.
Yeah. But you installed, I think I can put you on the spot because now it's been 3 years.
Yeah.
The Target didn't want to talk a lot about that. But they put solar on, I think, 17 stores, and it's basically all in We Energy's territory because of the net metering, and I don't think any Target in Alliant territory has solar.
That's exactly right. That's a good point. So, yes, we did 17 stores for a certain department. We had a certain department store decided they wanted to fill up as many roofs as they could with solar in Wisconsin. And so of the 17 projects, 15 of those were built in We Energy's territory because we had the 300-kilowatt net metering cap. They decided to do two with MG&E. There was a bit of negotiation that happened. They got to build those, and not a single one was built outside of those two utility service areas because the finances were just not feasible.
You know, one other comment I'd make, in some ways, too, from some of the conversations we're starting to have with our clients, because we're not just looking at distributed generation, but actually looking at microgrid technology, is we're having a lot more clients go, well, what do I do to get off grid, or what do I do so I'm not taking anything from the utility? I just want to have the utility there as a backup.
Yeah.
So in some ways, the net metering policies the utilities are putting in place are actually shooting themselves in the foot because we're starting to get more inquiries into how do I just get entirely disconnected?
Yeah, sure.
Yeah, and we'll come back to that. I think we want to talk a little bit about the value of those distributed generators and how in this world, as we start in 2020 and look ahead, I mean, what that missed opportunity might be. But for now, I want to shift gears from net metering and talk a little bit about permitting and inspection, and you all have to deal with this. Nick is doing a lot of work on this right now with soft costs. At MREA, he's been focused on reducing what we call soft costs, so not the solar panels, not the inverters, but the time it takes to get sales acquisition, the time it takes to get your permits, the time it takes to get inspected. You know, all of this adds up for our solar installers, and if we can cut all that down, then we can pass those savings on to customers. So tell us a little bit, Nick, about what you guys have been going on with that kind of education around permitting, inspection, and other parts of the soft cost world.
Yeah, certainly. And so, like you had mentioned, we're working on reducing soft costs, which is the, you know, everything outside of the hard costs of installation, components and things like that. So we're working with Renew and the Alliance for Regulatory Coordination to streamline the permitting process, streamline the inspection process. And a big part of what the MREA is bringing towards that is just education on the installation side and on the inspection side. So we're working with the International Association of Electrical Inspectors, Wisconsin chapter, to bring solar-specific training for all their electrical inspectors throughout the state. And so we're working with them this spring to do focused training on 1 to 3 hour segments. And then coming up this summer and this autumn, we're going to be working with the local technical colleges in the four different quarters of the state and getting hands-on inspections with the local inspectors, but then tying that into workforce development and training for the local tech college students. So the plan is the more trained we can, the more seamless the training is with this, the more educated approach people can take with it, the smoother and the faster it'll go, less time wasted on the front end there. And then also one thing we've been working with different communities to achieve SolSmart designation, which is we're working with the Solar Foundation based out of Washington, D.C., and that is to work with local communities. We're currently at 17 communities throughout Wisconsin, working with them to streamline their permitting process and make sure that the community has all the resources they have to make an educated permitting and inspection process for solar PV systems. Just to make things a little bit smoother.
Great. And Adam and Steve, I mean, how are you guys running into permitting and inspection, and how is that going in the field, and what opportunities do you see to try to streamline and reduce those costs? Maybe Adam, you want to kick that off?
Sure.
Particularly in residential projects, the cost just for demonstrating things that are simple building code standards can be a large percentage of a project. So streamlining that permitting process or making a simplified application and keeping it consistent by municipality or arming those municipalities with that same information. Consistent permitting costs is another big one on that front end. But they can really run away from you. Sometimes you'd have an $8,000 permit requirement for an inspection that took 30 minutes. And it's realistically what was the requirement from the municipality that you had to pay them that. And sometimes they're reasonable, sometimes they're not. But the engineering side of it can be, because a lot of these systems or types of systems haven't been applied, we're starting to get larger systems that are going in, municipalities start to get concerned, and sometimes they don't really have the concern. We're working through one right now where they want a full stormwater prevention plan. They know it doesn't need to be done, but it could be $20,000 to $30,000 in engineering just to show that you don't have to be concerned about it, because they're starting to see more of those applications. So those pieces become unattainable or can drive up costs that realistically, if we work proactively on the education and the outreach to the municipalities or utilities with interconnection rules and standards as well, those things can do great to streamline the process, help the communities and the utilities deal with the volume of systems that are coming at them, like just the sheer amount of interconnection applications, commissionings, and witness tests that utilities have to do now is insane. They have to bring on tons of new staff to do something that is a very simple procedure and won't require four people to be there, but their current procedures sometimes would have to coordinate that many people to get there. It can take 3 weeks to turn on a residential system that took a day to build. And so a lot of those efforts that MREA spearheading and a number of organizations in the state will go a long way to not or to keep reducing installation costs, as we saw with residential particularly, that there's a little uptick where things have kind of flatlined, and a lot of that is that embedded expense of trying to get a project permitted and okay to turn on at the back end.
Steve, any thoughts on that? I got a couple follow-ups related to this too.
I think it's really a three-pronged, you know, one is just reasonable. Reasonable requirements, both for municipalities, from the utilities for interconnection. It's education, so they understand the systems. I mean, the first microgrid we did, we had to have witness testing for every DER that was on the microgrid individually, which meant we had seven different rounds of witness testing. And after we had finished it all up, and then the engineering staff from the utility looked at it and said, you know what, next time you guys do this, we're going to do this once for the whole system. Because it's a system. It's not all these pieces, right? So, you know, and the third part of that is just getting consistency between, like, an interconnection between the utilities, too, and what the requirements are. I mean, we'll work with one utility where we'll do a large project, and basically it's like, okay, yeah, we file the paperwork. It's required. We're fine. We'll work with another utility. All the energy is being consumed on site, and they'll start talking about, yeah, you know, well, we're going to have to do an interconnection study, and so plan on budgeting another $30,000 to $50,000 for this. And it's like, what interconnection? There's nothing coming back to you. It's all going to be consumed by the client. We have controls in place to make sure nothing is exported. What do you have to worry about for an interconnection?
One place this has come up in recent, and Nick, maybe you can talk about this, is the fire code, and fire officials have, I think in La Crosse it's come up, but certainly at the national level, my understanding is fire protection has become more interested in solar as the number of solar panels on roofs has increased. They're interested in, well, how do we make sure we can properly fight the fires? Are we in a good place in Wisconsin on that, or do we have work to do on education or kind of working through some of the challenges with educating fire officials on code in that department?
Yeah, certainly. I mean, I think there's still a good bit, a good ways to travel in that regards. I think part of the confusion came from the California Fire Department there. They came up with California Fire Code. Then they revised that recently, and so some states are in different levels of adoption for it. And then in Wisconsin, there's been no clear rollout of uniform fire setbacks. And so essentially what we're talking about with fire setbacks is when we're building our systems on roofs, we have to make sure that we're leaving some space available, some pre-designated access pathways. And so it leaves it again, we come back to our issue of uniformity across jurisdictions, right? Whether it's interconnection
and interpretation
or anything else.
Of the code.
And interpretation of the code. There's plenty of ways to travel yet in that regard.
Great. I have a question on interconnection. We've talked a little bit about standardizing it. We can come back to that point, but I'm going to ask one more question up here, and then we're going to get questions from the audience and make sure you get your questions answered, okay? So the final question I got here is the theme of our summit is getting to 100% clean energy. At Renew, we envision distributed resources playing a really big role in helping to make that happen, both on megawatts and megawatt hours being a significant contributor, but also on showcasing the benefits all throughout our communities of what renewable energy really means. Because we do know, in our view, like large-scale wind farms, that's going to be some of the horsepower to really get the megawatt hours done, but we also want to be able to show the benefits, and we want all of our communities and people, companies, to be able to benefit from this. So what do you think we need to do to work together to get distributed resources and the benefits they can provide to really be part of this 100% clean energy framework? Steve?
Well, I'll tell you, it's something we've talked about in the past in some of the meetings we've had where it's really got to be the utilities and the consumers working together along with the regulatory agencies too. Because, again, we're going to shift. We're going to change. And we got to go to a smarter grid. We got to go to a grid where it isn't just utilities pushing out energy, but it's utilities more managing the moving of energy around that grid. And to do that, we have to give them the right tools, but we have to make sure the tools are fair and balanced for everybody, both for the generators, the consumers, and the people that may have no resources of their own. So that's our challenge, I think, really, to get there.
Yep. Nick?
Yeah, I think a fair and uniform policy or a uniformly applied a policy towards smaller distributed generation up through the utility scale would be a good stepping stone there. And then as we talked about having consistency across the interconnection process, the permitting process, having the net metering cap as a semi-stable, somewhat consistent would be a consistent value would be a good step also.
Yeah, Adam, how do you think distributed resources can really play a meaningful role in this transition? What do you think we need to do?
Well, rate structures and policy play a big piece. That's having regulators working collaboratively with utilities that offer opportunities that aren't just utility owned is a benefit, because to date it can be inconsistent or can change. I think there is a definite interest from a customer owned generation standpoint that it's investment in your community and ownership of a clean energy asset that ratepayers didn't pay for. And it's not regulated or mandated as long as you have policies and rates that help that adoption. And they can do wonderful things for organizations like nonprofit communities, or being able to tell a story of, say, a soup kitchen that now feeds more people because they're not paying for power that they buy from somewhere else. So there's really community benefits that just can't come from just large-scale, clean, renewable energy generated by a utility and pumped to everybody's houses through the distribution grid.
And if we do this right, it actually is not going to hurt the resiliency of the grid. It'll improve the resiliency of the grid as long as it's done correctly.
Yeah, and a lot of it, we don't have values or rate structures in our state or even in MISO that help to accommodate for that, where a utility could work collaboratively with another system owner to get those benefits even though they don't own and operate it. And we see some of it with some of the larger arrays that are going in that are developed or owned by someone else, and just it's a power purchase agreement. Mm-hmm. But the DG side is just an extension of it. And seeing what aggregated DER rules and values are, that has a lot of potential to generate a great opportunity without even doing more construction.
Yeah. And one of the other things we've talked about is that although the costs have come down a lot, there's still an upfront cost. So you're asking people to pay upfront for something that's gonna benefit them over time. And how do you improve the financing options? And we've talked about third-party ownership, power purchase agreements, leases. We don't have a clear status of the legality of that in the state of Wisconsin. But as you look at just from a pure market and selling to customers, do you see that as something that would really help boost this market, is being able to go to them with financing options if those were available to you?
Oh, that would help tremendously. I mean, it definitely helps outside of Wisconsin, the states where we're able to execute that way. It definitely helps move forward projects that if they were in Wisconsin, wouldn't be able to move forward, just because it's not something that that particular client would be able to finance themselves.
Great. Yeah. Anybody else want to take that hot potato?
No, I mean, I think that, yeah, it's a definite driver of solar growth, and one of the big aspect or one of the big markets for that is the nonprofit and governmental world, where they're not able to actualize those tax credits, and so having a third party that can utilize the tax credits to bring down the overall installed system cost is just huge.
All right, we're going to pass around. If you have a question, raise your hand, and we're going to move this mic around, and we're going to try to ask one question and a relatively succinct question, and then we're going to give succinct answers and try to get everybody's questions answered. So appreciate it.
So to what extent is the local grid near a proposed or planned say medium-sized solar array, to what extent is the local grid incapable of carrying the production from the facility, and does that stop projects? I'm thinking rural landowners, farmers, 10 miles from a substation, and you know, they're not going to rewire 10 miles back to the substation. So is this a problem? What do you see as a possible solution?
So my first answer would answer the first part of that would be it depends. In some areas it's not an issue. In some areas it's a big issue. In some areas it's not an issue of having the transmission capacity in the lines, but it's being able to handle if the energy's pushed back out. If I've got a large array and at times I'm pushing half a megawatt to a megawatt back out, if the substation that's up that line can handle that. More often it's the equipment more than it is the transmission facilities is what we see.
Yeah, well, I would say that would vary across the lines, like you say, and a lot of the larger solar farms are intentionally placed near utility substations, but then on the commercial levels, medium-sized systems, we can say, we've run into a fair amount of issues where there's distribution studies done by the utility that say only X amount of solar is allowed to be installed here and not a single kilowatt more. But there's very, very little transparency with that, where we are able to see the math on why that the further development's being squashed.
And generally, it's easier with a REC, with a rural electric co-op, than it is working with one of the big utilities. You know, I can say we had a situation I know in Illinois where there was a 1.5 megawatt solar array. It was being used Monday through Friday, full capacity, and weekends they wanted to push back out. And the utility, you know, said, well, we got to do an interconnection study. And looking at it, yeah, it was no problem. The lines could carry it. But even at the substation, there was no place to go with it. Because on weekends, it's a rural electric co-op. Their load was so low during the weekends, they carried about a half a megawatt load during the weekend in their whole utility. So what do you do with a megawatt and a half of electricity? They can't push it back up to their provider through their power agreements. So.
You mentioned the third-party ownership agreements. Could you just flesh that out a little bit more, how that's benefited some other states, and where are we in Wisconsin to maybe make that possible for us?
Let me take that one. So, for instance, we've executed a number of projects, for instance, in Minnesota, where we have the ability to do that. We've done actually a number of projects, wind-solar combination, with RECs. And it's been very profitable for both of us. I mean, it's given them a cheaper energy source than where they're currently buying energy from. And it gave our clients the ability to improve their spend, too. And that was through just a 15 or a 20-year purchase power agreement. So we come on site, we build the installation, we maintain the installation, and we basically act semi like a utility, right? We sell power to them.
Yeah, and where we where we stand in Wisconsin is Renew's position is that it's a gray area of the law. It's a question of public utility law and who is a public utility and who isn't a public utility. And so that question has not really been answered by the legislature or by a public service commission. There's been a few attempts to get the PSC to take this matter up, And thus far, the public service commissioners have said, use their discretion to not take the matter up. And so Eagle Point Solar has gone to court, and so there's a court proceeding on this. The initial court said kick it back to the Public Service Commission. So it's kind of it remains in an uncertain status, sort of what types of those arrangements and et cetera. So as far as scaling under a certainty of this kind of contract is legal, a lot of companies will not execute them because it's not certain that they won't someday have to go to court and defend it. So,
yeah, and Tyler, I think you hit it on the head as far as clarification so that the business models can be consistent and confident, which gives you lower cost to do a PPA with a customer, but then also policies that support it, because a lot of other places that have competitive PPA rates have different net metering policies, have different incentive structures that allow that PPA rate to be lower, and it simplifies the process because a developer or a solar developer or solar construction company that can do those PPAs takes on all the complexity of the project, and the customer just says, yeah, I want clean energy, and let me sign on these a bunch of legal agreements, so it can make that easier. But the backpinning of it is that consistent state law and policy, so it's outlined so businesses aren't afraid, and that your interconnection net metering rules or your SREC values or your state-based incentive programs, what they look like, will also determine how effective and impactful it is, and take it outside of just a nonprofit benefit where you're just getting it helps the nonprofits because they can't levy the tax credits.
Mm-hmm. And I will say in Wisconsin we have seen success from organizations doing equipment leasing.
Mm-hmm.
But the downside of an equipment lease versus a PPA, there's a performance guarantee, right? There's a certain amount of energy that's going to be delivered at a certain price. Anytime you do an equipment lease, that can't be tied to energy. If it's tied to energy, then it's seen as a PPA, and then you're in violation of state law.
Yeah, and if you switch it to an operating lease, you lose the tax credit with the nonprofit, so you lose the benefit to that one market that we could really apply it to in this state.
That has the most benefit from it.
More questions? Chris, we've got one back there.
Yeah, I had a question, Nick, for you. When you were doing the training for the inspectors, I know that some of the inspection hierarchy in Wisconsin has changed from local level to a state level, and I wondered how receptive they are to learning all the different, you know, codes and things that are involved with solar, because it is new, sometimes new to them.
Certainly. Yeah, I think that's a great question. And what we've seen on us, starting at the top at the state and trickling down to the local inspectors, there's been a lot of support for solar PV inspections and a lot of interest in furthering their education. They want to make sure that the solar electric systems going in are going to be top quality also. So they were trying to head it off. And so part of the trainings I wanted to mention earlier, but what we're doing is trying to work with local contractors also to find out what's most effective for them and what's going to fill their needs the most.
Okay. Yeah, so this is a different form of distributed generation. I went to the biogas session this morning, mm-hmm. and they mentioned that in Wisconsin, the digesters are not allowed to put their renewable natural gas into the pipeline system in the state of Wisconsin, so they're doing it in interstate pipeline system. What is that about, and how can we change that in Wisconsin?
Yeah, it's different than electricity. It's the natural gas system. So, yes, it is the case that the local natural gas distribution companies do not have to accept so basically they don't want impurities, is my understanding, is there's a large amount of risk from taking on renewable natural gas that's not 100% regular natural gas, and that's going through the pipeline, and it's going to go into your stove, and it's going to go into your furnace. So there's just a risk factor there of making sure that that's pure, whereas when you inject it into an interstate pipeline, the volume of gas is so great that you're talking about a drop in a bucket of water. So even if there's some impurities, it's like it's going to get diluted. So there's not going to be as much of a practical effect. And then from a legal sense, federally, the interstate pipelines are federally regulated, and they have to take it. That's just federal law. The state law, there is no state law that requires the locals ones to take it. And so that's where the market has evolved, yeah.
Are other states
That I don't know. The question was, are other states allowing, are other states or other local distribution utilities in other states allowing it? I don't know that answer.
And I can answer from our experience, there are some states that do.
There are some states where that does, biogas.
I
had another question for the panel, but does anybody else out there have one? Otherwise, we can close up with my real humdinger. I knew that would put all the hands down. So we talked a lot about solar. We did hit biogas. Thank you for that question. But we're looking at energy storage. You talked about microgrids. Just from a technology standpoint, you know, how are these technologies coming together? Are customers asking for it? You know, how can we really maximize the benefit of multiple types of distributed energy resources by putting them together to provide even more value to the grid and to customers? So that's my closer.
That's your close. That's a lot in one.
I know.
In one question. So again, we look at the ability to have storage, the ability to use other resources as the ability to build more resiliency, the ability to potentially be able to get off grid or lessen your risk if there is a grid interruption. And we campaigned for the aware this summer that you can have some pretty major grid interruptions. In the Fox Valley, we lost some customers for We Energies, lost power for 5 days. In the Wausau area, they lost for 5 to 6 days. And there were a number of issues that were created by that. So we're looking for ways we can improve that resiliency locally, and one of those ways was storage. You know, and the other argument we hear is, well, you know, the sun doesn't shine and the wind doesn't always blow. It's like, yeah, but I can save that energy from when it does to use it for when it doesn't. And they said, well, that's batteries. It's like, are you always going to have enough storage? It's like, well, are you always going to have a pile of coal sitting outside of that coal plant? That's just another form of stored energy. And we just have to be able to help change kind of that dialogue around, you know, what is normal, because people don't look at that the right way. I mean, it's just another way of storing what we have and being able to use it. And maybe be able to use things a little more efficiently than we do, or be able to deliver it a little more efficiently than we do. So we see that this is being critical in the future, is the ability to store. And
Nick, I know you guys have a solar plus storage training coming up. I don't know if you're part of that, but you want to talk about that and how these technologies are coming together.
Absolutely. Thank you. Yes, so what we've seen throughout our membership is that the interest in storage continues to grow year on year, and especially as technology advances, price point improves, it just becomes that much more of a compelling case. And like you say, this summer we saw tornadoes come through. A lot of people were without power close to a week. And so that's, we have been trying to allocate a lot of resources towards doing more storage training, and coming up in another week we will have 4 day storage training, and 1 day of that will be touring your microgrid at the Buboltz Nature Center up in Appleton. That would be a week from this coming Saturday, so about a week and a half. And so there's just that much more interest in it, and it's a very important, you know, very important topic. And I think one of the interesting sign of the times is that here you have Generac, one of the largest residential backup generator companies, that's built their, part of their livelihood is just on making backup power available. Now they invested heavily in the solar industry and have bought all in and have their own inverter and battery storage system. I mean, I think that says a lot right there.
Yeah, I didn't plant Nick to say that, but that I'm going to preview our final panel, where we're going to have the Chief Marketing Officer and Clean Energy Business Leader from Generac on stage talking about, you know, you're making a huge business change. Why? Yeah. What opportunities do you see? Clearly, they see some big business opportunities there. So,
perfect.
Adam, want to close this up?
Yeah. Well, it does create a big shift because of that ability to hold on to things that the argument was always intermittent. The Colorado was a great example with Xcel's RFPs that went out last year, where the wind or wind plus storage and solar plus storage were out competing the coal rates. So then they could use that as a plan to try to make that transition. Now they're like, okay, we know this can be more cost effective. Now how do we deal with the existing infrastructure that we have investments in? So it completely flips how we make that transition to 100% it's had. It also changes things for customers when they make when we try to work with a customer for a solar array only. Rate policy is a big consideration, and it starts to free you from that a little bit more because you're not as just dependent on not controlling your resource. It also can create additional resources that system can provide to the distribution grid. And what are our regulators and policymakers, how are they going to treat that? Because if they can create the right platforms for it, that'll create a lot of adoption where one aggregator can call on a bunch of resources, and they're doing it in Australia with a pilot that started a year ago. Instead of building a 5-megawatt power plant, they built 1,000 5 kW systems that were dispatchable. So now you basically can, on demand, call those systems with storage that makes that very, very possible and workable.
We're doing that in Hawaii right now.
Yep. Yeah, and so it definitely shifts the ability to use that resource more effectively for not just energy, but for power, for the ancillary grid services and the things that are going to make a better, smarter grid.
Mm-hmm. Well, on that note, I want to thank – yeah, we got one final note.
I was going to put one more plug in for Nick. So if you are interested in that course that they're doing next week, we have copies of their flyer at our table. Which gives information on the different tracks on the courses and the cost and more details. So if you are interested, please stop and grab one of those.
We have one more question over here.
Give him a softball.
So you're aware of the Deerfield and the high school. We put in a 450 kilowatt DC array, and the utility said that if we had more than 150 kilowatts per hour going back to the grid, we had to shut that down. So my question for you is, if anybody else is on that feeder line, can Alliant tell them they can't put a system in?
Well, not being a representative of Alliant, I can only speculate here, Cal. But so by the reasoning, if they say that if somebody makes a statement that the line cannot take any more electricity on it, and that's their reason for stopping your renewable deployment, reason would make it that 150 kilowatts is 150 kilowatts, whether it's coming from you or anyone else. So in theory, yes, that capacity would be used up by that logic. But what I would ask for you is if I could see the distribution study and the math that you're using for that assumption, and then I could maybe give you a better answer or give it to somebody a bit smarter to get us an answer.
Mm-hmm.
Have you not asked for it? Oh, well, I think that would be a good first step.
Mm-hmm. Just make sure you say please.
Yes. As long as you say please.
All right, everybody. We'll be up here for a couple minutes, but the final plenary session, as I mentioned, is kind of bringing this all together today. It's about our 2020 vision, not ours, but a lot of people's 100% clean energy. How are we going to get there? So we're going to talk with Nicole Tumeyer from Alliant Energy about utility scale transition. We're going to have Zerology talking about electric vehicles, and we're going to have Generac talking about their new business lines around energy storage and home energy management. So sort of people making big investments and big changes in the future and envisioning this happening. So that's going to start at 2:30, which is literally 10 minutes from now. So make your way over there and please join us for that final session. Thank the panelists once again.